There are monsters that roar. There are monsters who hunt. And then there are monsters who giggle. Her laughter was soft, high-pitched, almost charming. The kind of laugh that made neighbors smile. The kind that put people at ease. The kind you'd never suspect could hide something so dark. Neighbors said she was friendly, always bringing over casseroles, always ready with a kind word and warm smile. Men said she was devoted, the perfect wife, attentive, caring, dedicated. Police would later say she was one of the deadliest women in American history. Her name was Nanny Doss. They called her the Giggling Granny. She poisoned husbands, children, sisters, mothers, grandchildren, in-laws, sometimes for money, sometimes for love, sometimes for freedom, sometimes because she was bored, because they annoyed her, because they got in her way of the fantasy life she'd built in her head. For nearly 3 decades, she killed without suspicion, without question, without consequences. She was too charming, too friendly, too normal. Tonight on Among Monsters, we're stepping inside the mind of a woman who believed romance came from magazines and death came from the kitchen. A woman who confused love with fantasy, freedom with murder, and happiness with absence of anyone who disappointed her. This is Among Monsters, the show where we don't just tell you what monsters did, we ask why. I'm your host, Maya Vale, and tonight's story is a slow burn. No jump scares, no sudden violence, just a woman who smiled her way through murder and laughed while doing it. Between 1927 and 1954, Nanny Doss killed at least 11 people, probably more. The exact number? She couldn't remember. Didn't care to keep track. She fed them arsenic disguised as care. Rat poison wrapped in devotion. Deaths served with coffee and pie and prunes and love. And through it all, she never stopped smiling. Never stopped giggling that high-pitched, unsettling laugh. This isn't a story about evil that announces itself. This is about evil that bakes bread, that visits neighbors, that goes to church on Sundays, that reads romance novels on the porch and dreams of better days. This is about a woman who learned early that the world was cruel, who decided that the only way to survive was to be crueler. This is about a woman who killed her own children, who poisoned her own mother, who fed death to 5 different husbands, and smiled at every funeral. This is Nanny Doss. Nanny Hazel was born November 4th, 1905, in the rural town of Blue Mountain, Alabama. Population, barely enough to count. Industry, none. Hope, even less. She came into the world poor. Not just poor, desperately poor. Dirt floors that turned to mud when it rained. Walls that let the wind through. Winter so cold, you could see your breath inside the house. Hard work from the moment you could walk. Long days under southern sun that didn't care how old you were, or how tired you felt, or how much your back ached from bending over cotton plants. Her father, Lou Hazel, was a strict man, a control-everything kind of man, the kind of man who believed the world operated on his rules and his rules alone. He didn't believe in education, especially not for girls. He believed a woman's job was obedience, silence, work, marriage, children, nothing more. He'd say it plainly. Girls don't need to read. They need to learn to keep house, to obey their fathers. Then, obey their husbands. Nanny and her four siblings worked the farm from sunrise to dark. No school, no friends outside of the family, no birthday parties, no holidays, no childhood, really. Just work. Lou made sure of that. He was paranoid, obsessive, convinced the world was full of men who would corrupt his daughters. Predators lurking behind every tree. Danger in every stranger's smile. So he locked them away, metaphorically, sometimes literally. Nanny and her sisters weren't allowed to go to town alone, weren't allowed to talk to boys, weren't allowed to attend social functions or church socials or school dances. Lou controlled every aspect of their lives, what they wore, where they went, who they spoke to, what they thought. Nanny learned early. The world was controlled by men who decided what you were worth. Men who saw you as property. Men who treated love like ownership. And she learned to hate it, to resent it, to fantasize about escaping it. But there was one escape, one window into a different world. Romance magazines. True story. True romance. True confessions. Stories filled with passion, devotion, handsome men who swept women off their feet, perfect love that conquered all, happily ever after, guaranteed by the final page. Nanny smuggled them into the house, bought them with coins saved from selling eggs, hid them under her mattress, under loose floorboards, read them by candlelight when Lou was asleep. And the house was finally quiet. She devoured them. Every word. Every story. Every promise of life different from the one she was living. To her, those stories weren't fiction. They were prophecies. Promises. Blueprints for the life she deserved. The life she would have. If she could just get away from Lou. Get away from this farm. Get away from the prison disguised as family. In reality, would never, ever live up to those magazines. The men in real life would disappoint her over and over until disappointment turned to resentment. Resentment to rage and rage to poison. When Nanny was 7 years old, something happened that would haunt her for the rest of her life. Or at least, that's what she would claim. Whether it was an excuse or an explanation, we may never know. She and her family were traveling by train, a rare trip, maybe to visit relatives, maybe to Birmingham for supplies. The details are lost to time. But what happened next? Nanny remembered perfectly. Suddenly, without warning, a violent jolt. The train stopped too fast. Brakes engaged too hard. Something wrong with the tracks ahead. Nanny was thrown forward, her small body launched from the wooden seat. Her head slammed into the metal bar on the seat in front of her. Everything went black. When she woke, she was lying on the floor of the train car. People hovering over her. Voices asking if she was all right. Her mother's face worried. Her father's voice angry. Her head throbbed. A deep, pulsing pain that seemed to come from inside her skull. Her vision blurred at the edges. Doubled. Swam. She tried to sit up. The world tilted. Someone, maybe her mother, helped her back to the seat, told her to sit still, to be quiet, to stop making a scene. Her father didn't take her to the doctor. Lou didn't believe in doctors. Too expensive. She'd be fine. Stop crying. Stop complaining. You're not hurt that bad. But Nanny wasn't fine. In the days after the accident, she began having headaches. Not normal headaches. Blinding. Debilitating. Migraines that lasted days. That made light unbearable. That made sounds feel like knives. She'd have to lie in a dark room, a wet cloth over her eyes, waiting for the pain to pass. Hours, sometimes days. And when the headaches finally faded, something else took their place. Her mood changed. She became withdrawn, silent, more than usual. Then, without warning, explosive. Angry over nothing, screaming over small things, throwing objects, crying uncontrollably. Depression. Mood swings that came without trigger. Moments of disassociation where she felt disconnected. Like she was watching herself from the outside of her body. Like nothing was quite real. Like the world was happening to someone else. Modern doctors might say she suffered a traumatic brain injury, frontal lobe damage, the part of the brain that controls impulse, empathy, emotional regulation. They might say the accident changed the structure of her brain, altered her ability to process emotion, to understand consequences, to feel remorse. They might say in a different time, with different treatment, Nanny Doss might have been helped, might have been saved. But this was 1912, rural Alabama, and Nanny's father didn't believe in doctors. Years later, when police asked why she killed, Nanny would blame the accident. The head injury, she'd say, it changed me, made me different, made me capable of things I wouldn't have done otherwise. And maybe there's a truth to that. Maybe the accident did damage her brain. But here's what we know for certain. The accident may have changed how Nanny's brain worked, but it didn't create the monster. It didn't teach her to resent men. It didn't teach her that love should look like magazine stories. It didn't teach her that disappointment was a reason to kill. The accident damaged her brain, but her father, and the world he represented, that damaged her soul, and both would lead to murder. At 16 years old, Nanny finally escaped her father's house, or at least she thought she did. She got a job at the Linen Thread Company, a factory in town, 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, pennies for pay. But it was hers. For the first time in her life, Nanny was around other people, other young women, men who weren't her father, conversations that weren't about chores and obedience. She felt alive. That's where she met Charlie Braggs. Charlie was older, maybe early 20s, worked in the factory too. He wasn't handsome, not particularly. Square jaw, rough hands, a face that had seen hard work and not much joy. But he was interested. He noticed Nanny, started talking to her during breaks, walked her home a few times, and that was enough. Nanny had read about romance in her magazines, about men who wrote poetry, who brought flowers, who swept women off their feet with grand gestures and passionate declarations. Charlie Braggs was none of those things, but he was attention. And attention from anyone who wasn't her father felt like love. They married in 1921. Nanny was 16. Charlie was 23. Her father approved immediately. Not because he liked Charlie. Not because he thought the man would make his daughter happy. But because Charlie would take Nanny off his hands. One less mouth to feed. One less daughter to worry about. Nanny wore a simple dress. There were no flowers, no celebration, no romance. Just a quick ceremony, a signature on paper, and a move into Charlie's house. She thought she was escaping. She wasn't. Charlie drank. Not socially, not occasionally, constantly. He'd come home from the factory reeking of cheap whiskey, stumbled through the door, collapse in a chair, demand dinner, and Nanny would serve it, because that's what wives did. He cheated with women he met at bars, at work, anywhere. He didn't hide it, didn't apologize for it, would sometimes not come home for days, just gone. And when he'd return, reeking of perfume and alcohol, he'd expect Nanny to act like nothing happened. But worse than Charlie was his mother. Her name was Louisa, a cold woman, controlling, critical. She moved in with them almost immediately after the wedding. She ran the household like it was a military operation, told Nanny how to cook, how to clean, how to dress, how to speak. Nothing Nanny did was right. The food was too salty. The house wasn't clean enough. Her clothes were inappropriate. Her tone was disrespectful. Nanny had escaped her father's control, only to become trapped between a drunk, cheating husband and a mother-in-law who treated her like a servant. She wasn't free. She was imprisoned again. And the romance novels, the one that promised perfect love and perfect men, they felt like lies now, cruel jokes. Nanny stopped reading them for a while. What was the point? Real life would never measure up. Real men would never be the heroes from those stories. And slowly, so slowly, she might not have even noticed. Something inside her began to change. The resentment that had been building since childhood, it started to calcify, harden, turn into something else, something dangerous. Between 1923 and 1927, Nanny gave birth to four daughters, Malvina, Florine, and two others, whose names we only know from death certificates. Motherhood didn't soften Nanny's resentment. If anything, it deepened it. Four children meant more work, more responsibility, more reason she couldn't leave. Less freedom. Less time for herself. Less time for the romance magazine she still read in stolen moments between feeding and changing and cleaning. She wasn't cut out for motherhood. Or maybe she just resented what motherhood represented. Another trap. Another cage. Another way the world kept women locked down. Charlie was no help. He'd come home drunk, ignore the children, complain about the noise, then leave again. His mother, still living with them, criticized Nanny's parenting constantly. You're holding her wrong. You're feeding her too much. You're not disciplining them enough. You're too soft. You're too harsh. To everything. By 1927, Nanny was drowning. Drowning in responsibility she never wanted. In a life that looked nothing like the stories she'd read. In a reality that suffocated her a little more each day. And then, in the summer of 1927, two of her daughters died. Both were under 5 years old. Both died within months of each other. Doctors said it was food poisoning. Bad milk, maybe. Contaminated food. Tragic. But not uncommon in those days. No investigation, no autopsy, no questions. Just grief and sympathy for the poor mother who just lost two children so close together. But here's what the neighbors noticed. Nanny didn't cry. Not at the funerals, not in the days after, not when people came to offer condolences. She was blank, detached. Like she was watching it all happen to someone else. People whispered about it. How could a mother lose two children and show no emotion? What kind of woman doesn't grieve her own babies? Something's wrong with her. Something's off. But grief is strange, people said. Everyone processes loss differently. Maybe she's in shock. Maybe she'll break down later. She never did. Because Nanny Doss hadn't lost her children. She'd removed them. We can't know for certain. No bodies were exhumed. No autopsies were ever performed. But years later, when Nanny confessed to her other murders, she was suspiciously vague about those two daughters. She wouldn't confirm their deaths were murder, but she wouldn't deny it either. She'd just smile and change the subject. What we know for certain, Nanny learned something crucial in 1927. She learned that death could look like an accident, that poison could mimic illness, that tragedy garnered sympathy instead of suspicion. She learned that death could look like an accident, that poison could mimic illness, and most importantly, she learned that she felt nothing, no guilt, no remorse, no horror at what she'd done, just relief. And that's when Nanny Doss stopped being a victim of circumstance. She became something else entirely. In 1928, Charlie Briggs came home to an empty house. Nanny was gone. She'd taken Malvina and Florine, the two surviving daughters, packed their few belongings in worn suitcases, and disappeared. No note, no warning, no forwarding address. Just gone. Charlie was terrified. He later told people he suspected Nanny had poisoned their two dead daughters, that he'd been afraid he was next, that he'd wake up one morning with stomach cramps, with burning pain, with death creeping through his veins. That's why he didn't go to the police, why he didn't file a missing persons report, why he didn't hire investigators to track her down, why he let her go without a fight. He knew, or at least he suspected enough, and he was too scared to do anything about it. Nanny didn't go far. She moved back to Alabama, found work at another factory, rented a small house for herself and the girls in a town where no one knew her history. For the first time in her adult life, she was free, truly free. No drunk husband coming home at odd hours, no controlling mother-in-law watching her every move, no one telling her what to do or who to be or how to live. She could read her romance magazines without judgment, could spread them across the kitchen table, could lose herself in stories of perfect love and perfect men. She could dream about the life she wanted, about the husband she deserved, about the romance that was surely waiting for her somewhere. She could start over, fresh, clean, but freedom came with problems. Reality has a way of intruding on fantasy. Money was tight. Factory work didn't pay well. And she had two children to feed. Two growing girls who needed clothes and shoes and food. Work was hard. 12-hour shifts. Standing. Repetitive motion. Exhaustion that settled deep into her bones. And worse, Nanny was lonely. The house felt empty. The bed felt too big. The silence at night felt oppressive. She'd gotten rid of Charlie, gotten rid of his mother, gotten freedom. But freedom, she was discovering, felt like a lot like isolation. So she started reading the Lonely Hearts columns again. Personal ads from men seeking wives. Romance hiding in newspaper print. The possibility of love. Real love. The kind from her magazines. The kind that would finally fill the emptiness. She started writing letters, carefully crafted on her best stationery, describing herself as a widow, a devoted mother, a woman of faith and family values, a woman looking for companionship and love and partnership. She didn't mention the controlling father, the violent first husband, the two dead children. She presented herself as a heroine from her magazines, devoted, worthy of rescue. She sent letters to men across the South and waited, days, weeks, checking the mailbox obsessively. And then, one day, a response. His name was Frank Harrelson. He lived in Jacksonville, worked in a factory, seemed kind in his letter, used words like, devotion, and partnership, and forever. Nanny read that letter over and over, memorized every word, analyzed every phase. This could be it, she thought. This could be the one. The man from her stories. The love she'd been waiting for her entire life. She wrote back immediately. They exchanged letters for weeks, each one more intimate than the last. Declarations of affection, promises of happiness, plans for a future together. Within 2 months of that first letter, Nanny packed up the girls, now teenagers, and moved to Jacksonville to start her new life with her new husband, with the love that would finally be real. She married Frank Harrelson in the spring of 1929, and almost immediately, she realized she made a terrible mistake again. The pattern begins. Nanny married Frank Harrelson in 1929, met through a Lonely Hearts column, married within weeks. He seemed promising at first. He had a job, a house, seemed kind in his letters, but letters lie, or at least they hide things. Frank was an alcoholic, worse than Charlie, meaner. When Frank drank, which was every day, he became violent. He'd rage, throw things, hit Nanny, scream at the girls. He'd threaten to kill them all, say he'd burn the house down with them inside, that he'd strangle Nanny in her sleep, that no one would miss them. Nanny endured it for 16 years. 16 long years. Why? Because she had no other choice. She had two daughters to support, no money of her own, nowhere to go. And in 1930s, America, a woman who left her husband was judged, blamed. So Nanny stayed, but she wasn't idle. She kept reading her romance magazines, kept writing to Lonely Hearts column, kept planning her escape, planning her next life, planning Frank's death. She started small, learning about poisons, what was available, what symptoms they caused, how much she needed, how to hide it. Rat poison was easy to get. Every house had it. Every farm store sold it. Arsenic was in flypaper. Soak it in water. The poison would dissolve. Mix it into food or drink. And the best part? The symptoms looked like a natural illness. Stomach pain, vomiting, diarrhea, weakness. Doctors would call it food poisoning, or flu, or bad luck. Nanny practiced, not on Frank, not yet, just learning, experimenting with doses, watching how the poison worked. And in 1945, after 16 years of violence and fear, Frank Harrelson ate dinner and collapsed on the kitchen floor, convulsing, foaming at the mouth, gasping. Nanny watched, calm, still. She didn't call for help, didn't cry out, didn't try to save him. She just watched. Frank died within the hour. Doctors said it was a heart attack. Sudden, tragic, but not suspicious. He was a heavy drinker, poor health. These things happen. At the funeral, Nanny wore black. She smiled at mourners, accepted condolences with grace, and then, soft and high, she giggled. People noticed, but no one said anything. Grief does strange things, they thought. Some people laugh when they're overwhelmed. It's just shock. But it wasn't shock. Nanny wasn't grieving. She was celebrating. But for the first time in her life, she'd kill someone on purpose. She'd killed someone on purpose, and she'd gotten away with it. And she felt nothing. No guilt, no fear, no remorse. Just freedom. And a realization. If she could kill once and not get caught, she could kill again. Nanny didn't waste time. Within months of Frank's death, she was back in the Lonely Hearts columns, writing letters, sending photos, describing herself as a twice-widowed woman looking for love. The responses came quickly, dozens of them. Men across the country, all looking for companionship, all lonely, all vulnerable. She chose a man named Arlie Lanning from Lexington, North Carolina. A decent man by all accounts, hardworking, quiet, owned his own home. They married in 1947. For a while, a brief while, Nanny seemed happy. Arlie didn't drink, didn't cheat, didn't beat her. He went to work, came home, was kind to Melvina and Florine. But Arlie wasn't romantic. He didn't sweep Nanny off her feet, didn't write her poetry, didn't make grand gestures of love. He was just a man. A normal, boring, predictable man. He read the newspaper after dinner, went to bed early, talked about work and weather, and nothing that stirred Nanny's soul. And Nanny, who'd spent her whole life waiting for romance from her magazines, boring was worse than cruel. At least cruelty was passionate. At least violence proved someone felt something. But Arlie was empty, and Nanny couldn't stand it. In 1950, Arlie died suddenly. Heart attack, they said. Tragic, unexpected, but not suspicious. The house, which Arlie had paid off completely, went to Nanny. So did his life insurance, $1,500, a fortune in 1950. But Nanny wasn't done. 2 months after Arlie's death, his mother came to visit, to grieve her son, to see how Nanny was managing, to offer comfort. She died 3 days later. Food poisoning, they said. Tragic, but not suspicious. Then Nanny's own mother came to stay. Her name was Louisa. She'd been sick for years. Weak, frail. Nanny offered to care for her. What a devoted daughter, people said. Louisa died within a week. Then Nanny's younger sister, Dovie, visiting the house, helping Nanny through her grief, complained of stomach pain after dinner. Dead within hours. 4 deaths, all in the same house. All within months of each other. All sudden. All after eating meals prepared by Nanny. And still, still, no one suspected. Because Nanny was charming. She was friendly. She brought casseroles to neighbors. She volunteered at church. She giggled at socials. She was a grieving widow, a devoted daughter, a loving sister. She was the last person anyone would suspect of murder. And that was exactly the point. Nanny had learned the most important lessons of all. Charm is the perfect disguise. By the early 1950s, Nanny Doss had become something new. Something calculated. Something cold. A serial widow. A serial killer. 3 dead husbands. Insurance money from each. Properties. Freedom. But she wasn't satisfied. Because the murders weren't about money. Not really. They were about disappointment. About the gap between fantasy and reality. About men who promised love in letters, but delivered nothing in life. So Nanny kept writing. To the Lonely Hearts columns. To men across the country. To anyone who might be perfect. She met husband number 4, Richard Morton, in 1952. Richard lived in Kansas. He was charming in his letters, attentive, romantic. Everything Nanny had been looking for. She married him within weeks of meeting. But within months, Nanny realized Richard was another womanizer, another drunk, another disappointment. He'd lied in his letters, painted himself as something he wasn't, promised love he couldn't deliver. Richard died in 1953, less than a year into the marriage. Heart attack, they said. Sudden, but not suspicious for a man his age. This time, people started whispering. Four husbands, all dead, all sudden, but still, no investigation. Just sympathy. Poor Nanny. Such terrible luck with men. God must be testing her. Nanny collected the insurance money, sold the house, and moved again. This time to Oklahoma, looking for husband number five. The one who would finally be perfect. The one who would finally match the fantasy. His name was Samuel Doss, and he would be her last. Samuel Doss was a good man, by all accounts, by every measure society used. A gentleman, a church-going man, a man who believed in rules and routine and righteousness, a man who paid his bills on time, who never raised his voice, who helped his neighbors. Nanny met him through, you guessed it, a Lonely Hearts column, June 1953. Samuel's letter was different from the others. More formal, more proper. He quoted scripture, talked about finding a godly woman to share his golden years. Nanny liked that. After four failures, maybe what she needed was a religious man. A man guided by faith. A man who took his vows seriously. Maybe that was the answer. They exchanged letters for weeks. Samuel was careful. He asked questions about her faith, her values, her understanding of a wife's role in a Christian marriage. Nanny answered perfectly, told him what he wanted to hear. She was devoted to God, believed in traditional values, understood that a wife should be submissive to her husband, would honor and obey, and all the right words, even if she didn't believe a single one. They married in June of 1953 at Samuel's church, with his pastor officiating. At first, Samuel seemed different from the others. He didn't drink, didn't gamble, didn't cheat, didn't raise his hand to her. He worked hard at his job, came home on time, attended church every Sunday, Wednesday night prayer meetings, Saturday men's Bible study. But Samuel had rules, so many rules. Rules about money. He controlled every penny, every dollar, every cent. He gave Nanny an allowance, $5 a week for household expenses. Had to account for every penny, had to show receipts. Had to justify every purchase. If she went over, even by a few cents, he'd lecture her about financial responsibility, about waste, about the sin of poor stewardship, rules about behavior. Nanny wasn't allowed to visit neighbors without permission, wasn't allowed to attend social functions at church without him, wasn't allowed to have friends over unless Samuel approved of them first. Her dresses had to be modest, below the knee, high collars, nothing that might cause a man to stumble. Her hair had to be neat, not too styled, not too fashionable. Makeup was forbidden. Jewelry was vanity. Meals at precise times, 6 o'clock for dinner, not 5:59, not 6:01, 6 o'clock. Meat and potatoes every night. Nothing fancy, nothing spicy, nothing foreign. Good, plain, Christian food. Morning prayers before breakfast. Evening prayers before bed. Grace before every meal. Samuel would lead. Nanny would listen, always. But the worst rule, the one that broke something fundamental in Nanny, he banned her romance magazines, said they were sinful. Worldly, filled with ideas that corrupted women's minds, made them dissatisfied with their God-given roles. He found her collection, boxes of them, decades worth, her escape, her hope, her only connection to the life she'd always dreamt of. He made her watch while he burned them, every single one in the backyard in a barrel. Flames consuming the pages, smoke carrying away her fantasies. Nanny stood there, watching, silent, and something inside her snapped. Not loudly, not dramatically, just quietly. A final thread serving. That night, Nanny started planning. Not impulsively, not in rage, carefully. She knew where the rat poison was. She'd seen it in the garage. Samuel used it for his shed out back. She knew how much she'd need. She'd done this before, 4 times before. She knew how to make it look like illness, natural causes, God's will. Within weeks of the magazine burning, Samuel started getting sick. It started small. Stomach ache after dinner, nausea, nothing suspicious. Samuel thought it was something he ate, or stress from work, or maybe just his age catching up with him. He was 58. These things happen, but it got worse. The stomach pain became severe, sharp, constant. The nausea wouldn't stop. He couldn't keep food down. Started losing weight. Nanny played the concerned wife. She brought him ginger tea with extra poison. She made him soup laced with arsenic. She held the basin while he vomited and smiled to herself. Samuel's doctor was baffled. Ran tests. All came back negative. Maybe it's an ulcer. Maybe it's his gallbladder. Maybe it's his nerves. Cut out spicy food. Get more rest. Prescribe some medication. You'll be fine, Mr. Doss. But Samuel wasn't fine. The medication didn't help, because medication can't counteract poison. He'd have good days, days when Nanny didn't poison him, when she let him recover just enough, built his strength back up, then bad days, when she'd add it back, slowly. This cycle repeated for months. Good days, bad days, recovery, relapse. Samuel thought he was fighting some mysterious illness. In September of 1954, Samuel's condition worsened dramatically. He collapsed at work, was rushed to a hospital. Doctors thought he was dying. His organs were failing. His body was shutting down. His kidneys weren't functioning properly. His liver showed signs of damage. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. They kept him for 3 weeks, ran every test they could think of, and slowly, very slowly, Samuel improved, because Nanny wasn't there to poison him. His numbers stabilized. His strength returned. His color came back. The doctors were amazed. Whatever it was, it seemed to have passed. Must have been some kind of infection. Some kind of virus that worked its way out of his system. They discharged him October 4th, 1954. Told him to rest at home, eat well, take it easy. Nanny visited him the night before his release, October 4th, late afternoon. She brought him coffee and prunes, his favorite. Stewed prunes that she'd made at home. Brought in a mason jar with enough arsenic to stop his heart. Samuel was so happy to see her. 3 weeks in the hospital, he missed her. Missed home. Missed her cooking. He ate the prunes gratefully. Savored each one. Told her how good they were. How much he'd missed her food. How lucky he was to have such a devoted wife. She smiled. That smile she'd given all the others. Kissed his forehead. Patted his hand. Told him she'd see him tomorrow. That she'd prepare his favorite meal for when he came home. That everything would go back to normal. She left the hospital at 6 p.m. Samuel died at midnight, October 5th, 1954. The nurses found him, convulsing, foaming at the mouth, his body rigid. They tried to save him. Couldn't. The doctor who treated Samuel was called in. He looked at the body, at the symptoms, and he knew. This wasn't illness. This was murder. At Samuel Doss's funeral, something strange happened. Nanny giggled, not quietly, not hidden behind a handkerchief, loudly. Mourner stared. She giggled again and again, that high-pitched, uncomfortable laugh. People moved away from her, whispered to each other. What's wrong with her? Why is she laughing? This isn't normal. But one person wasn't just disturbed. One person was suspicious. The doctor who treated Samuel. He noticed something. Samuel's symptoms didn't match heart failure. The sudden decline. The brief recovery. The final rapid deterioration. It matched poisoning. Dr. Schwellenbein requested an autopsy. The medical examiner opened Samuel Doss's stomach and found enough arsenic to kill 20 men. Police were called immediately. October 12, 1954, they went to Nanny's house, knocked on the door. She answered with a smile. Of course, officers, come in. How can I help you? They searched her kitchen and found rat poison, arsenic powder, jars of water with flypaper soaking inside. Nanny Doss was arrested. She didn't run. She didn't cry. She didn't deny anything. She smiled, and then she started talking. Nanny Doss sat across from detectives in a small gray room, calm, composed, almost cheerful. She wore a simple dress, her hands folded in her lap, a slight smile on her face. The detectives were nervous. They'd never interrogated someone like this before. A grandmother. A woman who looked like she'd baked cookies and quilted blankets. They asked her about Samuel. Did you poison your husband? Nanny nodded. Yes, I did. Simple as that. No tears, no breakdown, no denial. Just yes. Why? Nanny shrugged. He took away my romance magazines. The detective stared at her. That's it? That's why you killed him? Nanny smiled wider. That and he was boring. The detectives exchanged glances. They asked about Richard Morton, husband number 4. Nanny nodded again. Yes, him too. He drank. He cheated. He wasn't what he promised to be. What about Arlie Lanning? Husband number 3. Yes. What about Frank Harrelson? Yes. What about Charlie? No. Nanny's smile faded slightly. Charlie I let live, though I thought about it many times. The detective leaned forward. How many? How many people did you kill? Nanny tilted her head, started counting on her fingers. 4 husbands, my mother, my sister Dovey, my mother-in-law, 2 of my daughters, 2 of my grandchildren. Wait, the detective interrupted. Your grandchildren? Nanny nodded. Malvina's babies. They cried too much, made it hard to sleep. The detective struggled to process what they were hearing. This woman, this smiling, giggling grandmother, had killed her own grandchildren because they cried. The confession lasted hours. Nanny explained, calmly, almost proudly, how she'd done it. She'd dissolve rat poison in coffee, soak arsenic into food, steep flypaper in water and mix it into prune juice. She'd learned over decades, through trial and error, through experimentation, perfecting the doses, learning what symptoms to expect, how long death would take. She talked about it like she was sharing recipes, matter of fact, detailed, precise. The detectives asked the questions everyone wanted answered. Why did you giggle? Why laugh at their funerals? Nanny's smile widened. I don't know. I just do. It's not funny. I know it's not funny, but I can't help it. It just comes out. By the end of the interrogation, even the hardened detectives looked shaken. 11 confirmed murders, probably more, spanning nearly 30 years. And all of it? Committed by a woman who smiled, who giggled, who looked like everyone's grandmother. Nanny Doss became a media sensation. Every paper in the country ran her story. They called her the Giggling Granny, the Lonely Hearts Killer, the Black Widow, the Lady Bluebeard. Reporters swarmed the courthouse. Photographers fought for shots of her. And Nanny? She loved it. She smiled for cameras, waved at reporters, signed autographs, posed for photographs. During her trial, she giggled at testimony, even at testimony about her own crimes and her dead husbands, her dead children, her dead grandchildren. The jury was horrified, but also fascinated. How could someone do this? How could someone kill so many people and feel nothing? Psychologists tried to evaluate her. Was she insane? Was she psychopathic? Was she simply evil? They couldn't agree. She understood right from wrong. She knew her actions would kill people. She planned her crimes carefully. So she wasn't legally insane. But she also showed no empathy, no remorse, no emotional connection to her victims. She talked about their deaths like she was discussing the weather. One psychologist said she had a childlike personality. Another said she suffered from severe narcissism. A third suggested the head injury had fundamentally altered her brain. But none of them could explain the giggling. That remained a mystery. Nanny Doss was sentenced to life in prison, not death, because Oklahoma didn't execute women at that time. She was sent to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary, minimum security wing. And there, in prison, Nanny continued her life as if nothing had changed. She read romance magazines, wrote letters to men, made friends with other inmates. She never expressed remorse, never apologized to the families of her victims, never seemed to understand the magnitude of what she'd done. When reporters asked if she felt guilty, she'd tilt her head and think about it. Then she'd say, "Not really. They were going to die eventually anyway." Nanny Doss spent the last 11 years of her life in prison, reading her magazines, giggling to herself, believing, even then, that somewhere out there was the perfect man, the one from the stories. She died in 1965, leukemia. She was 59 years old. Nanny Doss killed at least 11 people, probably more. The exact number will never be known. Over nearly 30 years, she fed them poison disguised as love. She smiled while they died. She laughed at their funerals. She collected their insurance money and moved on to the next victim without hesitation. And she never understood why that was wrong. Or maybe she understood and simply didn't care. Psychologists who studied her case struggled to explain her. Was she insane? Not legally. She knew right from wrong. She planned her crimes. She understood consequences. Was she evil? That depends on how you define evil. She didn't kill out of rage. She didn't kill for pleasure. She killed out of disappointment, out of resentment, out of a twisted belief that she deserved better. Was she simply broken? Perhaps. The head injury may have damaged something in her brain. Her childhood may have warped her understanding of love and control. But broken things still make choices. And Nanny chose murder. Again and again and again. What we know for certain, Nanny Doss was a woman who believed love came from magazines, who confused fantasy with reality, who thought happiness was an absence of anyone who disappointed her. She grew up controlled by men, by her father who locked her away, by husbands who cheated and drank and controlled her money. And eventually, she decided the only way to be free was to remove them. One poison at a time, one giggle at a time, one insurance check at a time. She represents something disturbing about human nature, the ability to rationalize anything, to justify violence, to commit murder and still see yourself as the victim. Nanny Doss never saw herself as a monster. She saw herself as romantic, a woman searching for love, a woman who'd be dealt a bad hand, a woman who'd simply be unlucky in her choices. And if the man didn't live up to the fantasy, if they disappointed her, if they controlled her, if they bored her, well, they could be replaced. The families of her victims spent decades trying to understand. Her daughter Malvina, who survived, lived with the knowledge that her mother had killed her two sisters and possibly her own children. She gave interviews later in life, talked about growing up afraid, never quite trusting her mother, always sensing something was wrong. The communities where Nanny lived struggled with the revelation. How could they have not seen it? How could a serial killer live among them for decades and no one suspected? Because she was charming. Because she giggled. Because she looked like everyone's grandmother. Nanny Doss proved something we don't like to admit. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Sometimes they look like us. Sometimes they bake pies. Sometimes they go to church. Sometimes they smile and laugh and seem perfectly normal. Until you look closer. Until you count the bodies. Next time on Among Monsters, we'll explore another case. Another killer who hid in plain sight. Another person who proved that evil doesn't always announce itself. This has been Among Monsters. I'm your host, Maya Vale. Until next time, stay curious, stay skeptical, and trust your instincts. Because sometimes, when someone seems too good to be true, they are. And maybe, skip the prunes.